I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Biden had ambitious plans for a clean energy revolution when he took office, 100% carbon-free electricity by 2035, and net zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. That goal is in serious jeopardy after Senator Joe Manchin said he would not support more money for climate and energy programs because it would drive up inflation. This was after a year of negotiations. Meanwhile, a third of the country is grappling with extreme heat, including here in Philadelphia. Yesterday, Biden spoke about the climate change threat at an event in Somerset, Massachusetts, with an empty lot that used to be the site of a coal-fired power plant as the backdrop. Here's a slightly edited clip.
So let me be clear. Climate change is an emergency. And in the coming weeks, I'm going to use the power I have as president to turn these words into formal, official government actions. When it comes to fighting climate change, I will not take no for an answer.
Biden announced plans to expand offshore wind energy and send money to communities to help them reduce the threat of soaring temperatures. He did not declare a climate emergency yesterday, as some had hoped he would. We asked Justin Warland to join us, a senior correspondent for Time magazine covering climate change. Justin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And let me begin with the fact that the president did not declare a climate emergency yesterday, although listening to that clip, he indicated it might be coming. Why is that significant, to declare a climate emergency?
Well, I think the big thing is to signal both to, you know, the American people and to companies in the U.S., as well as people around the world, that the U.S. is still committed to doing big things on climate, to trying to meet his goals that he set early in the administration to slice emissions in half by 2030 compared to 2005 levels, and just to show that he's still willing to do big things to get there. You know, on the flip side of it, there are, you know, it doesn't necessarily make up for all of the setbacks, but it's something to show that he's still serious.
How do we reconcile what the president has promised and what he did yesterday and his trip to Saudi Arabia to get more oil for the U.S. market and probably the global market as well?
Well, I think it's a really complicated set of challenges that the president is dealing with. I mean, on the one hand, he has to show some degree of seriousness about, you know, dealing with gas prices and showing that he is taking that challenge seriously. It's something that's front of mind for people while also thinking about, you know, the long-term challenges of decarbonization. And so, you know, I think he's trying to thread that needle. I think the reality is that, you know, we're going to be using oil for some time, you know, regardless of how fast the energy transition goes. And so you could say he's working with the energy source or the energy provider that's going to be around, you know, for the duration of however long we're using oil. But certainly it creates a weird split screen for people who are concerned about the urgency of the climate crisis.
Yeah, especially with that fist bump, right?
Yeah.
Not a good look. Well, let me ask you about the U.S. Supreme Court, their recent ruling that curtailed the government's ability to regulate carbon emissions from power plants. How significant is that?
Well, it's significant for a couple of reasons. I mean, so this was a relatively narrow ruling. The Supreme Court actually was ruling on a regulation that never took effect. And, you know, they ruled that the approach that the regulation took, that the EPA took to regulating carbon from power plants, they can't use that approach. And so, you know, it's relatively narrow, especially given that, you know, as I said, that rule had never taken effect. But it certainly is going to make the EPA and the administration more broadly think very carefully about how far they can go with other regulations, right? Are they going to face the same sort of pushback from the Supreme Court using the same line of reasoning for other regulations? And so it has cast a little bit of a, you know, a pall on the sort of prospects of sweeping regulations that could really drive emissions down. Having said that, there is a lot of room for what they would call inside the fence line, things that are really focused on reducing emissions at individual power plants. And there's still a lot of tools in the toolbox But certainly they're going to be very concerned about, you know, not stepping over the bounds of what the Supreme Court will allow.
And how significant is it, Senator Joe Manchin, as I mentioned in the introduction, has at least for now balked at the idea of signing on, I guess it's Build Back Better, is that what we're talking about? I've lost track of all the names of these proposals.
Build Back Better 3.0.
Yeah, 3.0, exactly. But that he refused, frankly, to sign on to some aspects of that bill to reduce carbon emissions. How significant is that?
I mean, it's really significant. You know, if you look at the different groups that do analysis about the numbers of emissions reduction, I mean, this is kind of the ballgame here. All of these regulations, all of these other things make a difference, but the sort of linchpin of being able to meet the president, President Biden's goals, was really congressional action. And so it's really hard to see how the numbers add up to meet the president's goals without congressional action. I mean, it didn't necessarily have to be, you know, Build Back Better in some iteration. It could be some other sort of policy mechanism. But without some sort of congressional action, it's pretty hard to see us getting where we need to go.
And it should be said that Senator Manchin founded a coal brokerage business. I'm quoting here from CNN. It's called Energy Systems. Apparently, in 2021, he made more than $500,000 from his holdings, which, of course, raises questions about conflict of interest and why, you know, a coal magnet in the U.S. Senate can derail energy and climate regulations and legislation.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many questions here. Joe Manchin, you know, said he was open to climate provisions, but only if they, you know, took out certain elements of it. And so they responded to that. Democrats responded to that. And then, you know, he had different demands, and then it was inflation. And I think a lot of people are asking right now, you know, was he negotiating in good faith, or was this whole thing just a sort of a distraction, and he was always going to do what he just did? And so, I mean, you know, a lot of people ask, and I've spoken to people who, you know, have the ability to call up Joe Manchin and talk to him. And you know, I think everybody wants to know, you know, what's actually going on in his head. And yeah, we don't actually know. So it's a very challenging conundrum to understand what he did and why he did it.
Well, here's a comment from Connie, who says, all the news is talking about Manchin. And what about all the Republicans that didn't sign this? It's not just Democrats who need clean air and clean water. I'm tired of hearing about Manchin. And let me, you can correct me, Justin, but it seems that he was negotiating, and I guess Democrats thought in good faith, where the Republicans apparently have no interest in negotiating when it comes to climate issues.
Well, that's, I mean, I think there are two things to say. Is 100% right, I mean, that he was negotiating, and so there's going to be some frustration where you spent a year plus of political capital trying to bring him along, and you know, him suggesting that he would do that, and then he doesn't. So there is that point. But I think it's important to talk about the fact that Republicans, you know, are the major roadblock here. At least the vast majority of them are, and none of them were negotiating on this particular piece of legislation. And you know, I mean, if you want to have a durable climate policy that comes from Congress, you're going to need to get some Republican support. So it's a good point to bring that up.
Is the U.S. or is the U.S. government, are we running out of options when it comes to what can be done to address the threat of climate change?
So I think it's important to say there are things that can be done, and there are things that the administration can do right away. And I expect that we're going to get more announcements in the next couple of weeks. Things like the Defense Production Act. The administration has already used the Defense Production Act to help stimulate production of solar panels, and as well as other efficiency technologies. So there's going to be more of that, I suspect. I think everyone suspects. You know, when you look at the big picture of trying to slash emissions in half by 2030, getting to that sort of net zero target by mid-century, you know, it's really hard. The tools are not really there with this administration without congressional action. But it's important to say, you know, there are things that can be done, there are things that should be done, and you know, it's not a binary where, you know, we meet that target or we do nothing. And, we've, you know, if we can get somewhere in between, that's better than nothing.
Would you say there is more action at the local level, maybe not across, not all states, but that some states are really being, thinking of California in particular, being very proactive when it comes to climate change policy?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely action at the subnational level, as they call it, and I think California would be a key example of a place that's really trying to move the ball forward and has a lot of power in doing that. I mean, California has the ability to set its own standards for cars, for example, and that's something that is helping galvanize the push for electric vehicles. You know, and there are also surprising, you know, states that aren't just California, places like Arizona, where there is a serious discussion about, you know, getting expanding clean energy, even though it's a red-leaning state these days. And so, yeah, across the country, there's a lot of possibility. And, you know, we often talk about what's happening at the national level with Biden and with Congress. And there's a lot of power at places like public utility commissions, right? This is something that the average person doesn't think at all about, but they, you know, they vote, or at least it's on their ballot to vote for public utility commissioners, and they can control the energy, electricity system in their state. So there's a lot of levers to be pulled at the state level, and that's going to become more important in the coming, you know, months and years.
Do we know what the public opinion about how the American people see the threat of climate change? Does it register? I'm assuming it registers when there's a storm or when it's, you know, 99 degrees. But is that a sustaining interest among the public people from what we can glean?
Yeah, it's really interesting and important point. I mean, the polling suggests that Americans are increasingly connecting the extreme weather that they're seeing with climate change. And so that's, of course, good. You know, there's a recent poll from Pew, 58% of Americans say the federal government is doing too little. But the challenge, of course, is, you know, it's one thing to say that they should be doing something. It's another thing to, you know, have that drive their vote, to have that drive engagement that really moves policy. And so, you know, and there's another poll, it's the YouGov poll, that, you know, while more than half of the people they polled in the U.S. said that climate change is important, it ranked last among their priorities.
Wow.
And so it's a question of prioritization.
Well, you know, Justin Moreland, we have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us on Radio Times and getting our conversation started talking about climate change. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And that is Justin Moreland, again, senior correspondent for Time Magazine covering climate change. We will continue our conversation, and we have climate scientist Michael Mann waiting in the wings. And we want to hear from you, as always, on Radio Times. Any questions or comments, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. A third of the country is under heat warnings or advisories as temperatures break records and in some cases clock well into the triple digits. This is true for other parts of the world. Extreme heat is a threat to public health and can destroy infrastructure like roads and rails and cause wildfires like the ones we're seeing in the West. According to the New York Times, heat waves in the U.S. have increased from an average of 2 per year back in the 1960s to 6 per year in the 2010s. The last 7 years have been the warmest on record for the entire world. This is further evidence that the climate crisis is real, but do we have the resolve, the will, the know-how to do what it takes to address the problem? Climate legislation is stalled in Congress while more of the action is taking place at the state and local level. We asked climate scientist Michael Mann to join us to talk about the warm warming world, what it means, what we can do about it. Currently professor of atmospheric science and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, author of a book that came out last year, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. He's coming to the University of Pennsylvania here in Philadelphia this fall as a presidential distinguished professor of environmental science. Michael Mann, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be with you. Maybe next time we can do this at the studio.
Wouldn't that be nice? And I should add that he joins us by Skype. Looking around the world, as I'm sure you do, Michael Mann, is this climate crisis getting worse and worse?
Well, there's no doubt it's getting worse. As we continue to pump carbon pollution into the atmosphere and warm up the planet, we are going to see more and more of the serious impacts of climate change. And all you have to do right now is turn on your television, read the headlines of your newspaper. The climate crisis is here. It's playing out in real time. These devastating extreme weather events, Philadelphia about to see triple digit temperatures with heat indices that'll be even higher because of the humidity. This is the face of climate change. This is the climate crisis. It's here and now.
I read or actually was watching a couple of interviews with you, and you said actually that some of the climate models failed to, and I'm quoting here, adequately link many extreme summer weather events to climate change. So even the models were off or didn't anticipate what it is we're dealing with today?
Yeah, that's right. And so, look, the models have proven remarkably valuable, and they have made remarkably accurate predictions of the overall warming of the planet. The planet has warmed up almost precisely what the models predicted it would in response to our ongoing carbon pollution, fossil fuel burning, and the rise in carbon dioxide concentrations, the increase in the greenhouse effect. Where the models have not done so well is in predicting some of the impacts of that warming. For example, the ice sheets, the collapse of the ice sheets, which has begun. It is sort of underway now. And that's contributing to sea level rise earlier than we expected it to. And these extreme weather events, we're seeing more frequent and more intense extreme weather events, the heat waves, drought, wildfire, floods, superstorms, than the models predicted. In both of those cases, the ice sheets and sea level rise or the extreme weather events, both of which are really where the rubber hits the road when it comes to dealing with the impacts, both of those involve processes that weren't well represented in the models. And now scientists have started to try to incorporate those processes into the climate models to make more accurate projections of these impacts. But it underscores the point that uncertainty is not our friend here. Critics, climate change contrarians, what I call inactivists in my book, The Forces of Inaction, the fossil fuel industry and those advocating for them, have tried to co-opt the notion of uncertainty as if it's somehow a reason for inaction. But if anything, it's a reason for even greater action, because some of these impacts are occurring faster and with greater magnitude than we predicted.
Are these extreme weather events that you just described, though, are they within that, 1.5 Celsius increase in temperatures? Is that happening within the attempts to try to prevent the, you know, the more catastrophic increase in global temperatures?
Yeah. And so, you know, like I said, the warming is pretty much what we expected it would be. And that's bad enough. These extreme weather events. So you can just look at the overall warming, and it's not rocket science. If you remember, your listeners think back to college or high school, the old bell curve that was used to assign grades, where it describes the probability, and at the edges of the bell curve, you get those very unlikely, or in this case, very low and high scores. And then the center of the bell curve is the average. It's where most of the action takes place. It's that far tail of the bell curve on the right side that describes the extreme events. And when you slide that curve over, that far tail sort of grows quite a bit. So you get a large increase in the amount of area under that curve that is in the far right tail, those extreme events, those 3 or 4 or 5 sigma events, as we call them. And so even a modest warming of about a degree Celsius, we've warmed the planet up about 1.2 degrees Celsius, better part of 2 degrees Fahrenheit, even that modest warming of the planet leads to a very large increase in the frequency of those extreme events at the far tail of that distribution. And that's what we're seeing. Now, that's part of it. And the models capture that part of it. But something else is going on here. And some of our own work in recent years has involved understanding this, how the warming of the planet and the pattern of the warming, where the Arctic is warming faster than the rest of the planet, so that actually reduces the difference in temperature between the low latitudes, the tropics and subtropics, and the high latitudes, the Arctic region, the polar region. And it's that temperature difference that drives the jet stream. And so it turns out to really solve this problem mathematically, you actually have to use some of the mathematics that was developed to solve problems in quantum mechanics decades ago. It's pretty complex mathematics, but when you work through it, what it shows is that the decrease in the contrast of temperature that comes with warming and the enhanced warming of the Arctic changes the behavior of the waves that make up the jet stream. You know those peaks and troughs that you see on a weather map when they're showing the jet stream, and where you see sort of a peak, there's a big high pressure region underneath that's hot, that's dry, that's wildfires. And where you see a trough, that's a low pressure. That's where you get a lot of rainfall. And those peaks and troughs get bigger, they get larger in amplitude, and they get stuck in place. And so our work shows that climate change is actually leading to those waves becoming larger in magnitude and getting stuck in place, where we get those really persistent extreme weather events. And the models don't do a good job in capturing that.
Does that explain what's going on in Europe? I was reading a couple of articles about what they are dealing with, and there were several references to changes in the jet stream. Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly what we're talking about. Right now, we're seeing what we call a wave 7 pattern. What that means is if you count the number of waves, the number of cycles as you follow the undulations of the jet stream around the northern hemisphere, and you count the peaks and troughs, you find that there are 7 full wavelengths as you make a circuit around the planet. And it turns out that normally those sort of wave 7 patterns aren't very energetic. But when you get this phenomenon that we're talking about, then those higher wave patterns, which really build up those intense local high and low pressure systems, they readily grow in amplitude. And that is going on right now. My colleagues in Germany that I've worked with on this problem at the Potsdam Climate Institute have diagnosed what's going on right now. And they've shown that there is this wave 7 pattern, as we call it, that is undergoing what we call resonance, which means it's growing in amplitude by this mechanism. And it's giving us that very intense high pressure over Europe that is giving them the record heat. And, you know, and we're seeing some of that back here in the United States this week.
And that is Michael Mann. He's a climate scientist joining us today on Radio Times to talk about the record heat that much of the world is dealing with and the fallout from our climate crisis. And again, you can join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Ray had a question. He wonders whether wars, constant bombing, even the kind of technology that we use to make weaponry, that he's wondering if that actually affects our climate. Is that measurable at all, Michael?
No. I mean, you know, you can anytime you sort of disturb the land or you generate, you know, an atmospheric disturbance and dust, that can have sort of a local impact. What I would draw, you know, attention to is a real link that almost certainly does exist between sort of this war that we're seeing go on right now, this aggression by Russia, their attack on Ukraine, which ultimately is an outgrowth of the tremendous power that Russia has attained because we are so reliant on them for their oil and gas, particularly in Europe. And so it is our reliance on fossil fuels and the same fossil fuels that are generating these catastrophic climate consequences. It's our reliance on fossil fuels that's allowed some of these petrostates like Russia under Vladimir Putin to grow in power and to to really exhibit this sort of aggression. So it's a reminder of all of the multivariate costs of our continued reliance on fossil fuels. We are propping up dictators and autocrats in places like in these petrostates like Russia and Saudi Arabia.
I remember interviewing you a couple of years ago. This was at the start of the pandemic when so much of our economy had shut down. People weren't driving to work. You know, lots of businesses, factories were closed. And there actually was a, as I recall you saying, a measurable difference when it came to CO2 emissions. We, of course, don't want a pandemic in order to reduce the threat of climate change. But what can be done to have a greener, safer world?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And, you know, we did see a dip in carbon emissions. They dropped about 7% last year in response to the pandemic. As you say, that is not how we want to reduce carbon emissions. The way we want to reduce them is by decarbonizing our economy. And the fleeting nature of that reduction, so they came down 7%, but they basically came back up to where they were before the pandemic this year. And what that tells us is that changes in lifestyle or the economy, a downturn in the economy, they can have sort of this fleeting short-term impact. But the only way we're going to get the reductions that we need, and by the way, 7% in a year is what we need. Every year, we need another 7% reductions beyond that. This year, another 7% reductions beyond that year, 7% every year. That gets us on that path that Justin was referring to earlier, where we need to reduce our carbon emissions by 50% to avoid 1.5 Celsius, 3 degree Fahrenheit warming of the planet, where we start to see even more catastrophic consequences. So we need to accomplish the same reductions that we saw in response to the pandemic every year, year after year, in a way that's sustainable. And the only way we're going to do that is by decarbonizing our economy, by getting off fossil fuels and doing so quickly.
The question is the resistance or is the problem, is it psychological? Is it political? Is it a matter of technology, about a matter of know-how? Do we know how to do this? We just have to get ourselves to do it.
Yeah, that's what's so frustrating. We know we have the technology. We know how to do this. And again, in your conversation earlier with Justin, I thought that you sort of focused on the critical roadblock here, the critical obstacle, which right now is a coal state Democrat who caucuses with Republicans on most matters these days, Joe Manchin. Literally, one person can block meaningful climate legislation, which is what we need. The only way that the United States makes good on its obligations to the rest of the world, and by the way, if we don't make good on our obligations, how do we expect China and India and everyone else to come to the table? The only way that happens is if we have legislation that codifies what this president, Joe Biden, has said to the world we need to do, we are going to do, which is to reduce our carbon emissions by 50%. We need legislation. We're at an impasse right now with this Congress, again, because there are 51 votes against climate legislation, including that one Democrat, Joe Manchin. Here's a solution to that problem. Massive voter turnout in the upcoming midterm elections. If voters can increase the majority of Democrats in the Senate and keep the House, we can get climate legislation. And many of the senators, including in our state here in Pennsylvania, the Democrat running for the open Senate seat, John Fetterman, has stated that he would vote to end the filibuster. And so if we can end the filibuster, if we have 50 votes and a tie-breaking vote by our vice president to end the filibuster, then all of a sudden that logjam disappears and we can get climate legislation, which could also be done by through reconciliation with just 50 votes if they were there. But all of these other things that we need to do as well.
Justin also talked about the fact that there is a lot of action at the state level. I mean, if Congress, if the U.S. Congress is in a kind of paralysis on this issue, can we make up the difference by states stepping up to the plate?
Yeah, Marty, I mean, that's what we did during the Trump years, right? I mean, we had a president and, you know, a Republican-controlled Congress that refused to do anything on climate, and yet we saw states stepping up, the West Coast states, California, Oregon, Washington, with California really leading the way and continuing to do so. But many of the mid-Atlantic and northeastern states, which I'm very proud to say under our current governor, Pennsylvania, has joined this consortium called REGI of states in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic. If you total up the population of all of the people who now live in states that are committed to legislation, these consortia of states that are committed to meaningful climate policy, it's about 30% of our population that lives in those states. So that's not trivial. That's progress. It's what kept us in the game during the Trump years. It's not enough to keep us in the game now because we need such dramatic reductions over the next 10 years. And so while it helps, and every little bit helps, we need climate policy at the national level if there is going to be any hope of meeting our obligations to the rest of the world.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Again, that's Michael Mann. He's currently professor of atmospheric science, director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Come fall, he'll be coming to the University of Pennsylvania as a presidential distinguished professor of environmental science. Wrote a book last year called The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. We are talking about our climate crisis. You probably have felt how hot it is out. That's just a little piece of what we're talking about. We're going to take a short break and then get back to our conversation. We want you to join us. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Many of the people in this world are experiencing record-breaking heat, devastating droughts, out-of-control wildfires, extreme storms. It's clear the world is facing a climate crisis. We're talking about what's driving this crisis, also some of the politics of climate change in Washington, D.C., and what can be done. And again, climate scientist Michael Mann is our guest. Michael, I'm sure people listening, and I feel this to a degree myself, listening to you talk, feeling like we're doomed. You know, it's too late. We don't have the politics to be able to address this problem. The clock is ticking. You know, we don't have forever to try to fix this problem. You've written about doomism, as you call it.
Yeah.
How much of that is a trap?
Yeah, it can be a trap. And look, you know, most of the people who fall victim to this do so for understandable reasons. It isn't just climate change, right? It's so many challenges and crises that we face right now. Sometimes it just all seems too much weight. How can we possibly deal with all these challenges? It's understandable. What we do have to understand is that that tendency for some to fall victim to doomism has been weaponized by some bad actors in this space. Look, they want you disengaged. They want you to give up. They don't care about the path that you take to inaction, whether it's denial, outright denial of the climate crisis, or denial that we can do anything about it. They don't care about the path that you take. They just care about the destination. They want you on the sidelines, not on the front lines. And I do talk about that at length and some examples of that in The New Climate War. And one of the things that I also try to drive home is that there are some legitimate reasons for optimism. As bad as it all feels, as hopeless as it sometimes feels, here are a few really critical points. Sure. First of all, the science tells us now that the planet stops warming up once our carbon emissions go to zero. So if we stop burning fossil fuels and stop generating carbon pollution, the planet stops warming up almost immediately. We used to think that it would take decades for that to happen. We now understand that the so-called the ocean carbon cycle, the ability of the ocean to absorb carbon, helps draw down carbon from the atmosphere, and it actually counteracts the warming once those emissions stop. So that's really important. Another important fact here, and there was a study that just came out in Nature, I think it was like a month and a half ago, looking at the commitments that were made in Glasgow, COP26, mm-hmm. So this was sort of a ratcheting up of the Paris commitments of the various countries. And there were some disappointments in Glasgow, and I've talked about that. You know, climate advocates didn't get everything they wanted. But there was enough progress that if you now total up all of the commitments made by the countries of the world coming out of Glasgow, and you look at if those countries meet those commitments, how much the planet will warm. For the first time, the warming's coming in under 2 degrees Celsius. That's, you know, less than 3.5, around 3.5 Fahrenheit. And so that's a huge amount of progress. We were headed towards close to 4 degrees Celsius warming before Paris. Now, potentially below 2 problems. 2 degrees C, that's still too high. We need to keep warming below 1.5 Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit, to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. And second, those are promises, but those promises have to be kept, and they have to be sort of backed up by policies on the ground. And that really brings us back to the issue of the United States, right? Because it's one thing for the Biden administration to promise to the rest of the world that we will reduce our carbon emissions 50% within the next decade, and that's great. But we have to be able to back that up with policy. And the only way that happens is with legislation. And the only way that happens is with voters turning out en masse in these midterm elections to elect climate advocates so that we have a solid majority to support meaningful climate action.
Let me read an email from Ali. It says, don't we want higher fuel prices to reflect, like a carbon tax, the real cost of burning fossil fuels, but not want people overburdened in the short run with wild gas prices? I mean, it seems that there's a choice. You make fossil fuels expensive, or you figure out how to invest in renewables in order to be competitive with fossil fuels. Is there a choice? Is it A or B, or is it all of the above?
Yeah, there's a real tension there, and I thought that the conversation that you and Justin had earlier about that was on point. You know, this is a short-term challenge that the president faces right now to avoid criticism about whether or not he's doing enough to try to, you know, maintain access to energy and to keep energy prices down. So there is all this political pressure on him to at least seem to be doing something, like drawing upon the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and taking other actions, encouraging foreign governments to increase their fossil fuel production in the short term. So it's really important to distinguish here between the short term and the long term. And there are things that probably have to happen in the short term that will provide, you know, if this president is to retain the political capital that he will need to work with potentially a more favorable Congress in the next term to pass climate legislation. He's going to need political capital. He's going to need public support. And so in the near term, he has to appear to be doing everything he can to address the short-term energy crisis, while at the same time not allowing that to sort of, and the fossil fuel industry wants to exploit this short-term crisis by forcing us to commit to long-term investments, new fossil fuel infrastructure, new pipelines. That's what we can't do. We can increase near-term production because right now we can't meet 100% of energy demand with renewables. We need to move in that direction. And as we move towards a greater and greater market share of renewables in the energy economy, then we will be in a position to really, you know, to phase out fossil fuels and to not be reliant on them when some sort of short-term crisis, increased demand because of a recession, because of a pandemic, We will be able to work our way through those crises without being forced to double down on fossil fuel production.
Do you see a role for nuclear power looking forward?
Well, you know, it's worth having that conversation. You know, I think there is a good faith debate to be had about the role of nuclear energy in the book. In The New Climate War, I sort of weigh in on this from my own perspective. Nuclear energy is really expensive.
Yeah.
So if it's all about finding inexpensive sources of clean energy, then that's, you know, that points us in the direction of wind, solar, geothermal, as well as energy conservation, smart grid technology, all of these other things that are low-hanging fruit that are a lot cheaper than nuclear. Why is nuclear so expensive? Because it's dangerous, and that means that there have to be very tight regulations. It's dangerous environmentally, of course, because of nuclear radiation, and we saw that here in Pennsylvania some years ago with Three Mile Island, it is dangerous from the standpoint of proliferation. And at a time when we have a superpower in Russia that is threatening all of a sudden to use nuclear arms, we're reminded of the proliferation risk associated with having fissionable materials around.
Here's a question from a listener. Is there any way that technology can be looked at to capture the heat out of the atmosphere and harness it to make renewable energy tools? What do you think, Michael Mann?
It's an interesting question.
Yeah.
I don't see any way per se to use sort of the atmospheric heating in that way. But there has been an argument that, you know, some argue that as long as we're burning fossil fuels, as long as we're, for example, burning natural gas, there is the possibility of, using the hydrogen that's generated to provide hydrogen cells, which are a clean source of energy backup. We're going to need energy backup. The wind isn't always blowing. The sun isn't always shining. So we need energy storage if we're going to undergo a clean energy transition. And there are various ways of energy of storing energy. Batteries, pumped hydro is another molten salts. There are all sorts of potential ways to store energy. But one of them is hydrogen cells. Now, what I just described, where you're burning natural gas and taking the hydrogen, that you're still burning fossil fuels and you're still generating carbon pollution. That's still a problem. I am much more impressed by the potential for what's known as green hydrogen, which is you use the extra energy you have from renewable energy when you've got the sun's shining, the wind's blowing, and you can't use all the energy that you're generating, so you want to save it for later. And again, hydrogen cells are a way to do that. And so green hydrogen, where you use renewable energy to power hydrogen cells, that's promising. So we need to look, we do need to be considering sort of outside the box possible technologies. And we have to distinguish between technologies that show real promise, and I think green hydrogen is in there, and technologies that potentially take us in exactly the wrong direction, like geoengineering, interfering with the climate system in some other way to try to offset warming, or massive carbon capture and sequestration, which is really expensive, which may not work very well, may not be deployable at scale, and currently is simply used as an excuse by polluters. Hey, look, we can deploy this technology in the future to clean up this problem, so let us continue to mine and burn these fossil fuels now. Too often, the promise of future technology is being used as an excuse for business as usual today, and we have to look out for that.
Here's a question from Jack having to do with carbon dioxide, but also comparing that to methane. He wonders or seems to believe that methane is much more dangerous than CO2. Is that true?
In the short term, methane is a more potent greenhouse gas. Just molecule for molecule, it's more effective at absorbing outgoing heat energy than a CO2 molecule, a methane molecule. Now, a methane exists in the atmosphere in much lower concentrations than CO2, and it also has a much shorter lifetime in the atmosphere. A methane molecule typically won't last for more than a decade before it reacts with other chemicals and disappears from the atmosphere. And so it is a more potent warming agent in the near term. But if you're looking at the committed long-term sort of warming and the collapse of ice sheets and sea level rise, the sort of longer-term threat of climate change, then CO2 is a much more important player. And that's why there is so much focus on CO2. CO2, carbon dioxide, is the main culprit here. But it is important to rein in these other greenhouse gases, like methane. Methane is a very potent warmer. And if we produce a whole lot of it over the next decade or two, it could push us, at least temporarily, past certain dangerous thresholds. So, yeah, we need to be keeping an eye on methane, and we need to recognize that despite the claim that natural gas, which is mostly methane, is somehow a potential solution, a bridge fuel to address the climate crisis, the solution to a problem created by the burning of fossil fuels cannot be the burning of fossil fuels. Methane isn't a bridge to the future. It's a methane, you know, burning natural gas. Methane is a bridge to nowhere, really.
Here's an email from Stan. He says the discussion of reducing greenhouse emissions must include the rest of the world. And then he goes on, the hysteria about climate change must be tempered by putting it into a world context. We must reduce our emissions. But if we had zero emissions, the problem would still exist. So he's saying, I mean, this is counter to what you were saying, Michael Mann. You're saying if we actually reduce to zero, we will get a benefit. Stan is not convinced.
Yeah, well, Stan, thanks for checking in with us and asking the question. I'm sure you know a lot of people out there who have similar questions, and the science tells us, you know, in fact, that no, when we stop putting carbon pollution into the atmosphere, when the net input of CO2 into the atmosphere reaches zero, the warming will stop. It's basic climate physics. And so basic climate physics combined with some sort of the physics and chemistry and biology of the oceans and the carbon cycle. And so that, you know, that the problem is the burning of fossil fuels and the production of carbon pollution. And the solution is stopping doing that. Now, Stan also asked about sort of, well, you know, we need to maintain an international focus here. Why all the, you know, focus on the United States?
Sure.
When, you know, we're only 20% or so of global carbon emissions. And that's true. But we are the largest cumulative polluter on the planet. We have put more carbon pollution into the atmosphere than any other country. Today, China is producing more on an annual basis than we are. And they are in the process of industrializing, and India is in the process of industrializing. So here's the real conundrum. If we don't take a leadership position as the world's largest cumulative polluter, we grew our economy for two centuries based on cheap but dirty fossil fuel energy that has polluted our atmosphere and endangers the planet. Here in Pennsylvania, of course, this is where oil was discovered in the U.S. The state was built on coal, and natural gas is part of the economy today. So those of us who live in Pennsylvania understand that, you know, it's contributed to economic growth. It had its day. You know, fossil fuels replaced whaling. We used to kill whales for their oil, and something better came along, and that was fossil fuels. Well, you know, something better has come along now, and that's renewable energy. And if the United States, as the world's largest cumulative emitter, doesn't take a leadership role, it's very difficult to see how we can convince China and India that they shouldn't have that same opportunity to grow their economy with cheap but dirty fossil fuel energy.
Michael Mann, we have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Marty.
You're very welcome. And he's professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University. He is coming to the University of Pennsylvania this fall as a presidential distinguished professor of environmental science. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.